He was one of those people then that just kept popping up where I was. And I really love when that happens. So, and seen him recently at the Tri-State Retreat too. And we talked a little bit. So I'm excited to hear his message. I won't take too much more time. I will give you Doug B. from the Wash One Group of NA in the Icona area.
Morning, I'm Doug, I'm an addict. For my friend Jen, I want to tell this story. I'm a storyteller. It's a special occasion. Every time I get an opportunity to speak at a special occasion, I always tell this story. I love to talk about the crackhead in the desert. So there was a crackhead who heard that they had good rocks and fat out in the desert. So, being a good crackhead, he went in search. So he gets out in the desert, he can't find the crack, and he gets lost. So he's lost in the desert, he thinks he's gonna die, he can't find his way out, he's crawling across the sand, scared and praying, and he comes over a sand dune, and he notices in the distance a ranch. And he says, "Hallelujah, I'm saved." And he goes running down to the ranch. And as he gets close, he discovers that it's abandoned. The fences are broke down. The windows are broken out. The door's wide open. But in the front yard of this ranch, there's one of those old-fashioned water pumps. So he's dying of thirst. He runs over to the water pump. He starts pumping it up and down. No water. He starts crying. He's desperate. He thinks he's going to die. And he notices that over on the side there's a little wooden box with a note on top of it. So he goes over and he reads the note. And the note says, "Underneath this box is a gallon of water. In order to get the pump to work, you must take this gallon of water and pour the whole thing down into the pump in order to prime the pump." Now, I love that story because I picture myself there and I ask myself the question, would I drink the water or would I pour it down in the pump? So, I'll tell you what the crackhead did when I'm done. But I want to give my buddy Jen something to think about. I'm Doug, I'm an addict. I was up at the campfire a little bit ago, and I heard a guy introduce himself and say, "Hello, family, I'm an addict." And when I got clean, there were people back where I'm from who always introduced themselves that way, and I adopted that. And for years and years and years, I always introduced myself by saying, "Hello, family." But we started a new home group about a year ago to read the Living Clean book. And we've been reading that book every week and discussing it. And there's a line in that book that says in every area, there's somebody that introduces himself by saying, "Hello, family," without understanding that for some of us, that word family has negative connotations. And so I catch myself and I don't introduce myself that way anymore. I just say, "Hello, I'm Doug. I'm an addict." And I work essentially for a church. It doesn't recognize itself as a church, but that's essentially what it is. And when I first got clean and first took that job, I was in a meeting with the director, and he said, "You know, I love what you guys do at 12-step meetings." He says, "I think it's effective, and I think it's good work." But he said, "I don't like the fact that you continue to identify yourself as an addict." So I had some time when I was new where it troubled me to say that. He believed that you get saved and your past is done, and that identifying yourself as an addict carries stigma. And so I wrestled with identifying myself that way for a while, but I was at a meeting one day of the other fellowship, and I heard a guy say that he was proud to be an alcoholic, and before he had found that fellowship, he was a low-down, sinking drunk. And that made things easy for me. I'm proud today to be an addict. There was a time when I was a low-down, no-good, lying, cheating, stealing, not bathing crackhead. You can't call me crackhead today. I'm proud to be an addict. I'm no longer that crackhead. And I was talking to some guys about the meeting, like my first spiritual awakening, my first meeting was in this area. I went to treatment close by here. And I remember identifying myself as a crackhead when I was in treatment. And I remember the therapist telling me, you weren't a crackhead. You're not a crackhead. You're an addict. And you know, that therapist said some things to me. She doesn't know how close she came to getting punched in the mouth. But there were things that she said to me that when I thought about them over the course of time, she was absolutely right. I'm not a crackhead today. I'm a recovering addict. I wanted to tell you that I was at a meeting and I heard one of those guys share, one of those people who shares on and on and on and on and on. And he said, my name's so-and-so, I don't know where to start. And the guy next to me elbowed me in the ribs and said, as close to the end as possible. That always stuck with me as well. I want to give you a little bit about my background, but I want to get through that as quickly as possible. I really believe through step work and looking back over my life that the first 5 years of my life was pretty doggone good. And that I have a thing with words and literature and books, and I still remember specifically what happened was that I discovered the word stupid without knowing what it meant. And I called my dad stupid. 5 years old, he whacked the stuffing out of me. And I believe that that was the beginning of having something happen inside of me that caused me to be uncomfortable in the world. I grew up in an abusive household. My dad was an old-fashioned alcoholic that never found this program. He used to beat me. I've been beaten, abused, thrown downstairs, kicked, hit with cords and fists and belts and straps and stuff. And I didn't know that that wasn't all right. I don't know if they had CYS when I was a kid. If they had, I'd have called on that mother. But again, I'm in treatment down here, and I'm telling that therapist about some of the things that happened to me, but I was excusing my dad, saying it was his fault. And I remember her saying, it wasn't your fault. Your father was an alcoholic. She almost got punched in the mouth. And I just grew up rough like that. And when I was 10 years old, there was always booze in the house, but it never had any attractiveness to me. I didn't like drinking. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. But when I was 10 years old, I smoked my first joint. And once I realized that putting something in me would change the way I felt, I was off and racing. And I started to drink because it would change the way I felt. And I became a wino at a young age. I drank a lot of Thunderbird. You know me, why me without grapes. I drank all through high school, smoked pot all through high school. And that was my way of being okay in the world. I went away to college for a little while. I didn't do well. I didn't know how to study. I was a bit of an athlete, but I made good grades on tests, but I didn't know how to do the work. And so they asked me to come home. They told me to leave and not come back. But college, what I discovered in college, 1977, they taught me how to play backgammon, how to do bong hits, and they taught me about Bob Marley. It was a good education for me. One of the highlights of my life, I got to see Bob Marley live. Before he died. That's why I wear my hair this way. I'm not a Rastafarian. I always kind of like, I always like the look, and I like the music, and I sure like smoking pot. I smoked pot every day for 20 years. The only thing that ever cured me of smoking pot was smoking crack. I snorted a lot of coke, but once I started smoking, I never smoked another joint. I never snorted another line. I smoked for about 8 years. I came home from college, got a job, living with my parents, doing okay, and my mom got sick. Really, my first introduction to this program, my mom was diagnosed with cancer like in 79 or 80, and I had a nervous breakdown, and they thought it was drugs related. I don't think it was. I really think it was stress related. I think I went crazy. But they put me into a mental institution. They introduced me to the program, but I wasn't ready, nowhere near. And my mom passed away in 82. I went back to school, got a degree in electronics, moved out to New Jersey. I had some good years down there. I called them Superman years. I was snorting methamphetamine. You couldn't tell me nothing. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. I was running around, making a lot of money, running with fast women, driving fast cars. My life was really, really good. And I met a woman who liked cocaine. And I would buy it for her. And then pretty soon I was buying it for us. And then pretty soon, forget her, I was buying it for me. And this went on for a couple of years. And in 1989, my dad was diagnosed with cancer back here in Houston. I'm from Houston, PA, small town. And I came back to be with my dad. I left that job. I had been working for RCA. I worked for General Electric down in New Jersey. Yeah, I had good jobs. And I came back here to nurse with my dad. And he died in 1990. I inherited that home I grew up in. I inherited a nice car. I inherited a bunch of money. I had some money saved. But I had a drug problem. And there was a kid I grew up with who I would give him money to buy coke, and he would bring it back, and I would snort it, and he would smoke it. And I watched him smoke a couple of times, and one day I made a mistake of telling him I wanted to try that. And I started smoking. I don't know if I was a crackhead from the first one. I know it didn't take long. And I smoked through all that money I had saved, all that money I had inherited, and went back to work, had another good job. And I kept it for a few years. It was good work. I loved the job I had. I loved the people I worked with. But I was smoking. And one day they called me in the office. They said, Doug, we like you. We like your work. But if you miss one more day, we're going to have to let you go. I said, all right, no problem. And they asked me if I had a problem. And I told them, no, everything's fine. I'm all right. But I got paid that week, started smoking, didn't go to work. They sent me a termination letter. And that would have been probably, I don't know, 95, 96. And my life got really, really bad. I was running with a guy who had good connections. And I was running that house I grew up in. I turned it into a crack house. And we were doing a lot of business. And somewhere along the line in there, I had made a sale to an undercover police officer. So they broke down the door in 97. And the drug task force put me to jail. I did 18 days in the Washington County Correctional Facility. My sister is not one of us, and she had sent me a small check. The day I got released, I cashed that check. I bought a pack of Marlboros. I can still remember that first cigarette. My legs got wobbly. I could hardly cross the street. And I took the rest of that money and bought a rock on the way home. And I hadn't smoked in a couple of weeks. I put the whole thing in the pipe and tried to get that blast, and it almost killed me. I thought my heart was going to stop. And I was laying there trying to come down. I'm one of them people that when I smoke, I crawl across the carpet. So I was down on the carpet for a while. And then I was laying on that couch eating Oreos. And I have a clear memory. I'll never forget. I ate a couple of Oreos, and I said to myself, that's enough. You don't need any more. And I ate a couple of more Oreos, and I said to myself, that's enough, you don't need any more. And I ate a couple of more Oreos, and it occurred to me that if I couldn't stop eating Oreos, well, how the hell was I ever going to stop smoking crack? And so I seriously contemplated suicide. I had some friends who had taken that path, and I knew it was an easy way out. I was living in a two-story building, jumping off the roof, wasn't going to get the job done. There was no more drugs in the house. I didn't own a gun, thank God, or I might have gotten it over with. I was afraid of the noose and afraid of the knife. I couldn't figure out how to kill myself. I wanted to run a hose from the exhaust pipe of the car, but the damn thing wouldn't start. And I didn't know what to do. And so they had told me when I had gotten arrested, if I wanted help, all I had to do was ask. And I made that phone call, and I asked for help. I love to tell the story about the two crackheads who made the suicide pact. They went up on top of a tall building. One of them, I didn't say nothing, he just jumped off the building. But on the way down, he changed his mind. He was trying to fly, screaming at the top of his lungs. The laws of gravity will not accommodate our stupidity. And whack, he was done. And the other guy's up on top of the building, looking down at the dead guy, trying to decide whether to jump or not. I like to think he said a little prayer, but as he was looking down, a priest come walking up. And the priest looked down at the dead guy, and he looked up at the guy on the roof, and he made the sign of the cross. And the guy up on the roof took it as a sign from God. He came running down off of the roof. He ran over to the priest and hugged him. He said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, Father. You saved my life." The priest said, "What are you talking about? I saved your life." The guy said, "I was up on top of that roof, about to jump. You came along and gave me a blessing. I took it as a sign from God. I decided not to jump." The priest said, "Son, I wasn't trying to give you a blessing. I said, if you jump from up there, it's all over." So, I mean, it was the thought of suicide that brought me here. And like I said, I went to treatment not far away. And I was down there, completed the program down there. I thank God that they sent me to treatment here in Somerset. Because as they sent me to the local treatment center back home, I know I would have gotten mad and walked out of that place. I was there long enough for the program to get a hold of me. And I still don't understand if it was a deliberate or if it was a coincidence or if it was the hand of God. I'm not clear what happened. But that same therapist who I hated so much, when she gave me a treatment plan, she released me from the treatment center on a Tuesday. And at the town I'm from, there's a Narcotics Anonymous meeting on Tuesday night. And I knew it was there. I had driven past that meeting 10, 20 times, and I'd seen you guys sitting out in the yard drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes. I'd ask somebody, "What are they doing?" And they said, "It's Narcotics Anonymous." I didn't know the first thing about Narcotics Anonymous, but I knew where it was. And so Tuesday night, I get back home from treatment. I get dressed. I got out to that meeting. I walk down the road to the church. I walk up the sidewalk. There's some people standing there talking. And I knew it was Narcotics Anonymous. The first guy I get to, I tap him on the back. I was just trying to break the ice. I said, "Is this a Narcotics Anonymous meeting?" He turned around, and it was a guy I had smoked crack with, had a year clean. He came over, threw his arms around me, and hugged me. And then his woman was there, and I smoked with her too. And she came over, and she hugged me as well. It wasn't a surprise. I knew them people. I had smoked with them. But then this other woman, who I had never seen before, she came over and hugged me. I said, "All right, I like this." And so I was at home in Narcotics Anonymous from those first hugs. And it wasn't necessarily sexual. There's a line in the literature that says that a simple, loving hug can make all the difference when we're hurting. It had been years and years and years since anybody had hugged me, anybody had loved me, anybody had made me feel welcome. I was at home in Narcotics Anonymous. I thank God that I got clean with people who believe in going to meetings every day. I don't go every day. I'm down to about 4 or 5 a week, but I still believe in being regular and meeting at them. That's the way I was taught. I got about 30 days clean out of that treatment center, and somebody I had used with called me up, and I was in the program. I had already gotten in touch with the power of group therapy. I was in an aftercare program. I loved Narcotics Anonymous. I loved what was going on in my life. Some kid asked me to get him some crack. I told him, "Look, I don't smoke anymore." I said, "I go to Narcotics Anonymous now." I said, "But if you give me $10, I'll hook you up." So the kid gave me $110, took me to the crack man's house. I put $10 in my pocket. I gave the crack man that $100. But when that crack man gave me them rocks, I got my first understanding of what you guys meant when you used the word powerless. Because there was absolutely nothing I could do to stop myself from reaching over and breaking off a piece like I had already done. and I put that in my pocket, and I gave the guy the rest of his rocks, and he dropped me off. It's still my home from Quash One. He dropped me off at that Monday night meeting. If you ever get a chance to go to a meeting with rocks in your pocket, don't do it. It was the longest hour of my life. But I went home and I used and started the cycle over again. And I was in a group, and I loved the group. And I still have a clear memory of being at that meeting with that group and having the therapist ask me my clean date. And I was honest, and I'll never forget the look that came over her face. She said, "Don, you used." And then I said, "Yeah, it wasn't a big deal to me at that time in my life." And she said, "We're going to have to throw you out of the group." And that was a big deal to me. I couldn't stand the thought of having to leave that group. And I went to that Tuesday night meeting in Houston that night, and I shared about what happened. I didn't cry, but my voice broke. I was real emotional. And after the meeting, there was a guy sitting over by himself, and I went over to him. The only reason I went over to him was because he was smoking Marlboros. I was sick and tired of bumming generic cigarettes. And I went over to bum a Marlboro off of him, and he said to me, words that changed my life. He said, "So you haven't surrendered yet, huh?" I said, "What do you mean?" I didn't understand. I never heard that before. He said, "Maybe you didn't relapse." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You have to have some recovery before you can relapse." And so that bothered me. I didn't know what he was talking about. And I kept going to meetings. I kept using. I kept going to jail, in and out, going back to work. But I really just wasn't able to get it together. And the last time I went to jail was September the 18th, 1998. That's my clean date. If I'm okay, if I don't take nothing, I'm about 3 weeks away from celebrating 16 years. But I always say that my clean date and my surrender date are not the same date. I clearly know the day I went into jail, September 18th. I know the day I got out of jail was Christmas Eve. But all the days in between are pretty much the same. So I can't pinpoint when it happened, but I'll never forget. What happened was that they locked you in a cell to serve lunch. And the jail cell door was locked. I was looking out the window. I saw cars go up the street. The kid's name was Benny. And Benny was one of us, but I had been buying crack from him. And he used and died of an overdose. But I seen this car go up the street, look just like Benny's car, and I was triggered. And I had a sudden, total, overwhelming, complete urge to get high, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I had that moment of clarity that we talked about. I had that wake up that what had happened was that every time in my life I ever felt like using, I had used. And there was nothing I could do about it. The jail cell door was locked. And I had been around here. And you guys had talked to me about prayer. I really didn't know anything about prayer. But I hit my knees in that jail cell and I prayed. And I just said, "God, if you're real and you can hear me, I want to try living my life different. And I'm going to need your help so I can live my life without drugs." And I know that it was my moment of surrender. Because it was without a doubt the scariest thing that I had ever done in my life. I like to drive fast. I had driven cars like maniacs, driven drunk. I had smoked when my heart told me stop. I had faced guns when people told me to go away. And I wasn't afraid. I had never been as afraid as I was when I was on my knees asking God to help me live clean. It was the scariest thing I had ever done. And I always say this, that I didn't see Jesus Christ. I didn't see no great white light. The jail cell door did not pop open. But when I got up off my knees, I was free. Everything was different in my life. It was my moment of surrender. For a long time, I didn't know how to describe what had happened to me. I remember being at a meeting and hearing a newcomer say he didn't know if he had surrendered yet or not. And the guy beside me elbowed me in the ribs and said, if he had surrendered, he would know. I remember being at a meeting and hearing a woman share that to her, surrender meant she protected herself from herself. She said, "I am my own worst enemy." And those words stuck with me. I went home that night, wrote that down. I looked up the word surrender in the dictionary. My dictionary defined surrender as yielding to a power greater than oneself. But I believe what happened on my knees in that jail cell was that I surrendered to a God. I didn't even understand, but I surrendered. I surrendered into this program. And I've surrendered every day ever since. I get up early in the morning and I talk to my God and I surrender. And I'm trying to stay surrendered. Today, to me, surrender means I don't have to fight anymore. I have a job that I love. I have a boss that I love working with. But I don't always agree with him, but I'm surrendered to my boss. He tells me to go, I go. He tells me to come, I come. He tells me to do this. If I don't agree, I argue, but I know when to stop arguing and go do what he tells me. I'm happily married today. I thank God for this program. This program has taught me how to be a marriage partner. And I'm surrendered to my wife. She tells me to go, I go. She tells me to come, I go. She tells me to do it this way, but I don't agree. I might argue with her. I don't argue long. I'm surrendered to my wife. I don't have to fight anymore. And I love the program that's taught me how to live a surrendered life. And that's what I'm doing today. I wanted to tell you this, that what happened, like Sunday morning is a funny time for me. Because I work essentially for a church. We don't describe ourselves as a church. We describe ourselves as a Christian homeless shelter. But it's essentially a church. It's essentially a hospital. We don't call ourselves a hospital, but damn it, we're filled with sick people. So I work for a church. And sometimes, and it's not my main job, but sometimes they'll ask me to go preach on a Sunday morning. I'm not a preacher, but Sunday morning when somebody asks me to speak, I'm used to putting on a suit and tie. So Sunday morning is a funny time for me. I'm used to going to church. When they interviewed me to hire me, they asked me if I belonged to a church. I told them no. I said, but I like church. I go every Sunday. They said, Doug, if you're going to do this work, you're going to have to join a church. They said, this work will burn you out. And they said, you're going to have to go to a church to get recharged. So Sunday morning, still funny time for me. I'm just used to being in church. I'm a church guy. I searched for a long time to find the right church. I've been to a lot of churches. I would go to a church and I might like the music, and I might like the preacher, but I didn't like the people. Or I go to a church where I like the preacher and I like the people, but I didn't like the music. Or I go to a church where I like the music and I like the people, but the preacher preached too long. I couldn't find the right church. And then somebody said to me, Doug, if you find the perfect church, they ain't letting you in. And so I really kind of relaxed and I joined the church where I just really, it had what I wanted. And I was a regular there for a long time. And then they accused the pastor of stealing all the money. Now, he's still my pastor. I still support him financially. I don't care what he does with the money. Because it's really not, for me, about worrying about the oversight. My pastor says he understands God. I don't. So I go to hear what he has to say. I practice the same principles at church that I practice at meetings. I take what I need and leave the rest. But I go. I've been going. Now, on that morning, back in 96, when the drug task force tore down my door and took me to church, the lady across the street, I had grown up with her son. She considers me an orphan because both of my parents passed away, and she adopted me. She's always been a mother to me. Thank God I've had a lot of mothers in this life. And she was a mother to me, and she knew I was smoking crack. She would always tell me, you need to stop what you're doing over there. And she would tell me, you need to stop having all them crazy people over there. And she would tell me, I'm coming over there. And she would feed me. She always took care of me in my addiction. And the day that the police took me out of handcuffs, she was watching. And later on I found out that as they were taking me to jail, she followed the police car to the jail. They were downstairs processing me. She was upstairs trying to get in to see me. And it touched me. And I made a vow that when I got out of jail, I was going to go to church with her. And I did. I started going to church. I'd love to tell this story, too, that she invited me to go to hear this faith healer. I didn't know anything about that. I was raised Catholic. And I had rejected Catholicism at a young age. My mother forced me to go to Mass every Sunday until I was too old for her to force me to do anything. But I didn't like to be forced, So I didn't like church. I didn't like the fact that we were the only black family there, and it was a big church. And people were real friendly to us on Sunday. But I'd see them same people on Tuesday. They wouldn't know who I was. That always bothered me. Plus, my dad didn't go to church, and my friends didn't go to Catholic church. And the priest would stand up there in the pulpit and say, if you weren't a good Catholic, you were going to hell. That bothered me. So I had rejected Catholicism at a young age, but I was real okay with religion. I did everything religiously. I smoked crack religiously. And so when that woman told me about this faith healer, I figured, what the heck? I didn't have anything to lose. They said he was an African guy born around the country, and he was healing people and casting out demons. And I could not stop smoking crack. I figured, I'm going to go. Maybe he can help me out. So I go to this church service, and this guy is laying hands on people's foreheads. They're falling out. I don't know what's going on. I've never been to anything like that before. I'm sitting there kind of checking it out, and I decide, like I said, I ain't got nothing to lose. So I go up front. I still don't know what happened. The guy put his hand on my forehead. When I woke up, I was laying on my back. The whole church was laughing. All I know is I was smoking crack the next day. It worked for me. But I became a church guy. And when I got out of jail, I started going to church. When I got my job, I started going to church. I like church. I'm going to tell you this, that what happened for me is the Washington County Jail is right across the street from the Washington City Mission. So I would be sitting in that jail cell. I would be watching the activity at this homeless shelter. One of the things, I like jail. I can do jail. It's life I don't know how to do. I like jail. Because in jail, they tell you when to get up, when to go to bed. And I play cards all day. Jail's real comfortable for me with being on the street that I didn't understand how to do. But there was a big sign over the door there said, Jesus saves. That was attractive to me because the jail was cold. That place just looked warm. They give you one blanket. If they catch you with two blankets, they put you in a hole. Now, I was cold all the time in jail. And the place looked warm. And then they have a women's part. And so I would watch these women go in and out. And I was like, God, I want one of those. I've been smoking so long, I hadn't been in a relationship. And I had made a decision when I was in jail. I prayed and I said, God, I said, you know, I don't want to work with things anymore. I know how to work with electronics. But I said, I really want to work with people. And so when I got out of jail, when I was in rehab, they told me not to go. They told me I should go to the mission when I was down here in treatment. I had a home. I went back home. I used again. First time I got out of jail, I went home. I used again. Second time I got out of jail, I went home. I used again. The third time I got out of jail, I didn't go home. I haven't used since. So I bought into that argument about people, places, things. I got out of jail. I went across the street to the city mission. I've been there ever since. I lived there most of 99. They hired me in the year 2000. I love to talk about Dwayne Dorham. He was a retired state trooper. He was the first guy I met when I walked in the door. 6'6", brother. He walks up to me and says, son, me and you gotta talk. I looked up at him. I said, yeah, right, buddy, you're a cop. I ain't got nothing to say to you. And so I avoided that guy. But every day at the mission, they do a devotional service, 7 a.m., he stood up there and preached. One morning after I had been there for a few weeks, he was preaching about relationships. There was 50 guys in a room, but it felt like he had singled me out, like he had read my mail, like he was talking to me. And when he was done, I went up to him and I said, Dwayne, me, you got to talk. And he took me up into his office. We talked for an hour and a half. It was a conversation I'll never forget because it was a conversation that changed my life. Later on, I found out he said the same thing to everybody he counseled. But what he said to me was, he said, Doug, you know, God can use you. And when he said it, those words hit me down here and something inside of me broke. Because I knew it was the truth. And I started crying like a baby. And we talked for a while longer, and he stood up and he bent down and grabbed my hands and pulled me up to my feet. He held my hands and he stood there and he said, son, I want to pray for you. And I said, you go right ahead. And he closed his eyes and He started talking to God, just like God was in the room with us. At that time of my life, I didn't have any way to understand that God was in the room with us. But he asked God to bless me and to take care of me. And that night, I was living in a dorm room with 20 guys. I was miserable. I had never had to live like that before. I couldn't sleep. Guys were snoring and snorting and carrying on at night. And I hadn't had a good night's sleep in a long time. That night I hit my knees. You guys have told me hit my knees. I got down on my knees in that dorm room and I prayed. I said, God, please, if you can hear me, help me fall asleep and help me wake up feeling rested and refreshed. And I don't really know, again, I don't know what happened. Sometimes I think it was just sheer exhaustion. But I choose to believe it was my second step. That it was about God hearing my cry and answering. Because what happened was, when I closed my eyes, I laid down and closed my eyes, I fell right to sleep. I slept the whole night through. I woke up feeling good the next day. I started praying that prayer every night. And then, right after that, I was reading the Reader's Digest, and there was a little line at the end of the story that said, if you don't believe in the power of prayer, you're not praying enough. And I went from praying at night to praying in the morning. They taught me when I was new to put my cigarettes under the bed. They said, if you put your cigarettes under the bed, first thing you'll do when you get up is get down there to get them. They said, while you're down there praying, ask God to help you get through the day. So I put my cigarettes under the bed. I'd pray at night to help me sleep. I'd pray in the morning for another day clean. I started praying about food. Look, when I got clean, I weighed less than 150 pounds. Today, I'm 220. There wasn't a whole lot left of me when I got clean. They called it the Jenny Crack diet. But I was real grateful to eat. I still am. I still got food issues. I'd pray and thank God for my meals. And I just learned to pray. And right at about that same time, they told me, Doug, how do you expect God to listen to you if you're not listening to God? And again, that made sense to me. And I had always had Bibles. I had never read them. I got in touch with what they call a one-year Bible reading plan. I started reading the Bible. Read a little bit every day. Read it cover to cover. You started in the beginning of the year. If you read it every day at the end of the year, you read it cover to cover. I did that every day for 10 years. And then, you know, I started reading it just for today in the morning. I'd read the Bible in the morning. I got a hold of some other daily books from other fellowships. I got a hold of daily meditations from church and Christian stuff. At one point, I'm an addict. At one point, I was getting up early in the morning and read 27 different daily devotions. Just trying to figure this stuff out. And I did that for a long time. Now, I've whittled it down. I'm down to only reading about 4 or 5. But I still read that stuff every day. Because it helps me to start my day, to keep my mind focused on God, and to keep my mind focused on how I'm trying to live. I don't know how to live. But I always share this too, just because it's funny to me, but that idea of praying on your knees, it was weird to me. Once I got a prayer life and I knew God was hearing me, I didn't understand how every time I wanted to pray, I was supposed to stop what I was doing and get on my knees. And then I heard a speaker at a convention say, and he believed that prayer was a little bit like sex, that the position didn't matter as long as you made contact. And so that always stuck with me as well. I still pray on my knees. But I no longer do it because I think it influences God. I do it to remind myself that there is a God and that it ain't me. That there is a God and I'm just showing up for service. I don't necessarily believe that prayer is a posture, but I believe that prayer works. And so I pray. I get up early every day and I talk to God. And today my prayers are mainly prayers of gratitude. I'm just so grateful to be alive, grateful to have another chance, grateful that things are working out, grateful to know that there's a God who will help me. Every time I ask for help, God's always been there to help me. So I pray. I really want to thank the committee for asking me to come down here and share. It's just been a great opportunity. I still get really, really nervous. I was sitting there shaking, my heart was racing as you guys were doing the readings. This is an awesome opportunity. I love this convention. I've been down here. I've shared down here before. I told Court on the phone that I was not staying in no cabin. My wife was supposed to come I know she would never stay in one of those cabins. I did spend a night in a cabin one year. And what happened was the next morning, I went down to use the bathroom and shower, and I sat down, took care of business. There wasn't a doggone toilet paper. Man, I was mad. So I heard somebody else come in the bathroom. I said, "Thank God you're here. Can you give me some toilet paper?" But there wasn't any in the next stall either. I didn't have no socks on. How many socks have I put on? That guy ended up giving me $2. But small price to pay. But, I'm not a camping out guy. Somebody told me that his idea of camping out was Red Roof Inn. So I spent last night in a hotel. But it was a nice trip. My wife didn't come. I will say this, that what happened was that I've been blessed in my job. I don't make a whole lot of money. I work in ministry. But they did buy me a cell phone. I never had one. When I took that job, I didn't have a cell phone. And for years, I resisted it. And then they gave me a little more responsibility. And they told me, "Doug, you have to have a cell phone. We need to be able to contact you." But they pay for it. So I was glad. Now, this is their phone. And I had one like this for a long time. It's a flip phone. And what happened was at Christmas time, I happened to be at a ministerial meeting. I'm not a minister, that my job sent me because somebody else was off work. So I go to this ministerial meeting. There's 15 ministers sitting around the table having a discussion. One of them quotes the Bible. All 15 of them whip out their smartphones and start doing this, looking up the Bible on their phone. It bothered me that I couldn't do that. And then right at the same time, my wife took me to her nephew's for a Christmas party, and they were making fun of my flip phone. So I went back to work, and I told them, "You know what, I need a smartphone." And they got me one. And you get used to them real quick. That's got some nice apps on there. So what happened was Friday afternoon, what I discovered was you couldn't call my phone. Like everything else worked. You could text, you could FaceTime on it, you could the internet was still there, but you couldn't call in. And it's an iPhone, so you know, I got in touch with Apple, kind of restore it, reset it, but I couldn't figure it out. So my wife says she don't really want to come down here. She just got a new job, she's a nurse, she's making good money, she wanted to go shopping. So I said, "Well, baby, why don't you take my phone to the Apple store, because it's a half an hour away, and I'll go head on down to the retreat." And she took my phone to the Apple store. She called me, and she said to me that, you know, they fixed it. I said, "What was wrong?" She said, "Somehow you had gone into the settings and had it on call forwarding, but without giving another number." That's why I was doing that. I said, "Well, how much did they charge you?" She said it was free. But I'm going to tell you this, that here's what happened. And it's one of the reasons why I love the program. I love the things that have happened to me since I've been here. Like, I had this flip phone, so I was still able to communicate with her. But, you know, yesterday morning, I wanted to get down here early. I had some things to do, some work to take care of. And I was running in and out, doing a little of this, doing a little of that. I was working in the house. And something told me, I always say I know what something is. Something told me, go out to the truck and get that flip phone. So I go out to the truck, I get the flip phone, I bring it in the house, I set it down, I go back to what I'm doing. I'm telling you, 30 seconds later, the phone rang, it was my wife. I love the fact that God talks to me and directs me. I'm getting guidance from God. I don't believe that there's anything better that can happen to me than have God speak to me. God spoke to me, told me to go get that phone. Now it's little stuff. But it just feels so good to know that when I pray, God's hearing me. I remember, like, early on when I was working at this place, there was a guy who had been there a long time, and every time he would pray by saying, "God, give them the desires of their heart." Well, what I come to find out was that line was straight out of the Bible. And what the Bible says is if you delight yourself in the Lord, He'll give you the desires of your heart. So as soon as I got that, I started praying fervently for a Cadillac. "God, I want a Cadillac." And I prayed that prayer on my knees, day and night. fervently. I'm bombarding the gates of heaven with prayer for Kavanaugh. After about 2 weeks, I heard the voice of God speak to me, just like I'm talking to you, clear as a bell. God said to me, son, if you want a Cadillac, get a driver's license. I hadn't had a license in years. And I have a felony drug conviction. I had to serve a 1-year suspension for a felony drug conviction. I had to serve 2 6-month suspensions for driving without a license. So when I heard God say that, I started taking the steps I needed to take to get my license restored. And I started saving money. It took me 2 years to get a driver's license. After 2 years, I had $2,000 saved up. I got my driver's license. And what I discovered was that God had given me the desire of my heart, but it wasn't for a Cadillac. It was for an F-150 pickup truck. That was all I wanted. And this guy, Dwayne Dorham, who had taught me to pray, who had been my first spiritual advisor, who was a retired state trooper, sold cars on the side. And I called him up. I told him I wanted an F-150. He said, I'll call you right back. He says, come on down to the dealership right now. They had just taken one in on trade. I paid $1,600 cash for it. I still had enough to get insurance. I drove that truck for 10 years, put a clutch in it and a water pump. Sold it for $500. That was a good truck. And I got another one. I got an F-150 out in the parking lot. Never did get a Cadillac. But I learned from that that when I prayed, that God would hear me and answer me. I tell people all the time that I've come to believe that God speaks to me in 5 different ways. Sometimes he speaks to me audibly. I have heard the voice of God. Usually he's telling me, don't do that. And then once I stopped doing that, what I would hear God say is, I love you. Be happy. Sometimes I hear God telling me, call for an F-150. But I've heard the voice of God. I believe God speaks to me through the literature. That's why I love to read. I'm reading different books, different authors. But I've learned a lot about God from the literature. I believe that God writes books. And he's in those books. I can find him, get closer to him by reading. I believe God speaks to us through each other. That's why I still go to meetings. I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say that they were struggling with something. They went to a meeting and heard just what they needed to hear. I believe God speaks to us through each other. Oftentimes, when I go to a meeting and hear something, it's the one person I can't see who says just what I need to hear. I have a clear memory of being in a meeting, but one of those guys who went on and on and on and on was talking. He started talking. I tuned him right out. I was thinking about what I needed to do after the meeting, what I was going to eat, thinking about the rest of my day. And he talked so long, finally I decided to tune him back in. And just at the moment that I tuned him back in, what he said, this is my program, and you can't work my program, and I can't work your program. I'll never forget hearing that guy say that. I need to listen. I've learned to listen in meetings. God speaks to me through the people at meetings. My sponsor told me that the simplest form of meditation is learning how to listen, and that God speaks through each of us in meetings. So if I really wanted to learn to meditate, just go to a meeting and listen. And it made it simple for me. I believe that God speaks to me through this right here. I believe that this right here is never, ever, 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 ever steered me wrong. I can trust my gut to that. This right here steered me wrong 10,000 times. This out here steered me wrong over and over and over again. But my belly has never steered me wrong. I've learned to trust my gut. I heard a woman share at a meeting one night that she was on the beam. And again, I was really able to identify with that. When I'm on the beam, my gut feels good. When I'm about to do some shit I shouldn't do, my gut doesn't feel right. And I can trust my gut and get right back on the beam. And I believe God speaks to us through dreams and visions. And I won't go into that, but I've had God speak to me that way. And I've learned to trust the dreams and the visions as well. I believe God is speaking to us and speaking to all of us all of the time. So I'm just really delighted to be here and grateful to have this program. I want to share this, and I think I'm done. One of the really nice things for me is I work with us every day. And so I had a guy who I really like. I think he's a really smart guy. I think he has a good chance of making it. And I mean, came to stay where I'm staying to get involved in our program. And he was filled with enthusiasm and really happy and doing well for the first couple of weeks. And then I talked to him one day and something happened. He was just furious. He said, "I'm leaving. I'm getting out of here." I didn't want to try to talk the guy into staying. That's not my role. But I wanted to know why he had gotten so angry. And I just talked to him a little bit about that and about in terms of where that anger leads us when we shut down. And we talked for a little while and I left him alone. But the next day I saw him first thing in the morning. And I went over to him and he was smiling again. And I knew he was back at peace. But on Friday, I had an opportunity. A couple of people that worked for me were not at work. And so I had to do some stuff on the road. And I took this guy with me so we could have some one-on-one time. And as soon as he got in the van with me, he shut the door and he said, "So tell me about faith, guys." Which I'm like, "All right, yeah. Gonna be a good day. Come get to preach." And so, I opened up my mouth, but I wanted to start slow so I could kind of feel where the conversation was going. And I said a few things to him, and he immediately just started talking. And what I found out probably was that in part he just needed to unburden himself. I really didn't have to say anything. And we spent the morning together. We had a great time talking. The conversation did come back to faith. And so I'll share this with you, that what happened was that we were talking about faith, and I told him this, and I'll share this with you as well, that I met this guy, Dwayne Dorham, this retired state cop, and one morning he was preaching, and I was still new, and he was talking about faith, and he was talking about his daughter. He said his five-year-old daughter was walking down the stairs, and he said to his daughter, "Jump." And he said his daughter never paused, she never hesitated, she never thought about it, she just jumped. And he said she came so fast and it scared him, and for a moment he was afraid she was going to hit the ground. He said he dived over and snagged her out of the air. He said it was incredible to him how much his daughter had faith. And he said when he thought about his own life, he felt like what was going on for him was that he was getting up in the morning and saying his prayers and getting dressed and walking down the stairs, and that God was at the bottom of the staircase saying, "Jump, Dwayne, jump." And he was saying, "That's all right, I see you, God, but I got this, I do it myself." And I've come to believe today that when God called me to jump, I need to jump. I love to tell a story about the guy who was at the Grand Canyon, and he was just blown away by the scenery. He was in awe, and he was so enthusiastic about what he saw that he lost sight of where he was. He took one step too many, and he fell in. And he was on his way to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He knew he was going to die. His life flashed before his eyes. He was screaming at the top of his lungs. And he was trying to fly and trying to run. And just before he hit the bottom, he manages to snag a tree branch. And he's holding on to that tree branch. And he's scared. He's shaking. He doesn't know what to do. And suddenly he has a bright idea. And he looks up and he says, "Is there anybody up there?" And a voice from above answers him and says, "Yes, there is." And he says, "What do I do?" And the voice from above answers him and says, "Let go." And he says, "Is there anybody else up there?" I love that story. Because the guy was almost at the bottom. All he had to do was let go. And I've watched people hold on till they die. And for some people, it's holding on to the needle. And for some people, it's holding on to the ball. For some people, it's holding on to the pill. For me, it was holding on to the pipe. If you smoke crack with me, I won't touch my pipe. For some people, it's holding on to old ideas or old truths or old people. But I watch people hold on. And I know that I have to learn how to let go. That's why I still go to meetings. We speak the language of letting go. I never knew how to let go of anything until I came in to this program. It's a beautiful life. spent a few minutes this morning down the road a few miles in the cemetery. I had something happen to me about 5-6 years ago, and it was a devastating blow. And I found out I was in some pretty bad financial trouble, and it happened at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday afternoon. I worked at a church, and I found out Friday morning. I would have went and talked to one of the pastors I worked with. I would have talked to one of the counselors I worked with. I would have went and talked to somebody. But it was 3:30 on a Friday afternoon. I just wanted to get out of there. I knew better than to go home feeling the way I felt. So I ran down towards the mall. I was going to go to the mall and get a brand new pair of tennis shoes. When I'm jammed up, a brand new pair of tennis shoes will go a whole long way to making me feel better. But as I was on my way to the mall, I realized I didn't have any money and I didn't have any more credit. I was in trouble financially. And so I called my sponsor. He didn't answer. But in Washington, we got a big cemetery, and there's a high spot up in that cemetery where they got a park bench, and you can see from up there the whole city of Washington. You can see down into West Virginia and down into Ohio. I went up and I sat on that park bench. I started talking to God about my situation. And I had the absolute wonderful experience being up here in the Laurel Highlands, looking out over the beautiful scenery, reminded me of that day. But I had an awesome experience sitting on that park bench, as if God had reached down and picked me up and given me a 10,000 foot perspective. And from up there, he said to me, Doug, he said, look down. He said, you see all those thousands and thousands of tombstones? I said, yeah, God. He said, in 100 years, you're going to be under one of them. Ain't nothing that important. It changed my perspective. It helped me to relax and to live my life loose. Ain't really nothing that important. None of it's going to matter 100 years from now. He says, you're going to be under one of them tombstones too. I don't take too much too seriously anymore, except for my recovery. And I love to tell stories. I got one more, and I'm going to finish, if that's okay. How am I doing, Court? Am I okay? I just wanted to tell this one more story before I go, because this is where I'm living my life today. I love to tell the story about the guy who was walking through the forest, and he saw a tiger. And he got scared, and he started to run. And the tiger saw him running and started chasing. And so he burst out of the trees, and right in front of him is a cliff. And he begins to lower himself down over the side of the cliff. And as he lowers himself, he looks down and he notices that there's a tiger beneath him looking up. So he's got a tiger above him looking down, drooling, and a tiger below him looking up, licking his lips. And he realizes that right in front of him is a great big red ripe strawberry. So he plucks the strawberry, he takes a bite of the strawberry, and he says, that's a good strawberry. So for me, the tiger above him represents the past. I watch people who stop moving away from the past and they're devoured by it. That tiger below him, for me, represents the future. I meet people every day who are scared to death about what's going to happen to them tomorrow, what's going to happen next week, what's going to happen next month, and they're letting that tiger below them devour them. For me, today, that strawberry is this moment. Right here, right now with you. Because I've come to believe deeply in my heart that right here, right now with you, my life is just absolutely perfect. I don't have a care in the world. There's nothing wrong. All my issues are issues that come as I start thinking about what I did, or I start thinking about what's going to happen. But if I can learn to stay here, present in the moment, every day, every moment, it's like a great big red ripe strawberry. I'm just really loving my life today. Things are working great for me. I'm done. So the crackhead in the desert, I think he was one of us. Because I think somebody had told him about following suggestions. Now, I might have drank the water, but the crackhead in the desert took the gallon. He poured the whole thing down the hole. When he was done, he started cranking the handle, and sure enough, it primed the pump, and water started coming out. He drank as much as he could till water was coming out his eyes and his ears. He bathed in it and showered in it and washed himself and drank some more. And then he filled that jar back up again, and he put that jar back underneath the box. But before he left, he took a pencil, and at the bottom of the note, he wrote, "It works! It really works!" Thanks, Mark.